The yellow flag has been shown. The red flag is being taken away. The lights will go to red.
Away they go. Good start from Danny Pedrosa. When have we never said that? Here we go. Valentino Rossi had a good start.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about my 200-mile charity walk for Wales Air Ambulance, which starts on Friday the 17th of August. Just going to pause there. If you listen carefully, you'll hear two screams coming from around the California area. Okay, that was obviously a joke, so here's the real one.
And hello, welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode 331. For Wednesday, August 8th.
And you are?
Oh, I am Len Padilla. I'm coming to you from Pamplona, Spain. And Martin, I believe, is in Welshpool, north of Wales.
I certainly am, yeah. Crashing in the office tonight. I'm kipping at the office because we had some calls to do. We're going to have a wrap-up of World Superbike at Silverstone. And to that end, we managed to, I managed to speak to James Whitten, friend of the show. And James got about 25 minutes and he's talking about Silverstone, crazy weekend. Obviously, we'll go through that as well. But we do have to give a great shout out. We've had some donators in the last week. We've got Conscious Pilot LLC, which I presume is a play on Pontius Pilot, but it's very good. So thank you, Conscious Pilot LLC. Michael Grigas. You got any more insight on how you pronounce that, Len, than I have?
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's really his name. Maybe he's just testing you.
Michael Grigas. But Michael, thank you very much indeed. And Rogerio Sabino, or Rogerio Sabino, also contributed. Guys, thank you. Jim and Jules have just been at Laguna Seca. It is incredibly expensive just living at these days, let alone getting ourselves down there. But they did put together a fantastic show. Some great interviews in there as well. Lovely hearing Hervé and Lucio Ceccanello as well back on the show. Yeah, bit of errata. The amount of apexes the corkscrew has. I don't know. Four apexes, technically not really. Jim says, to my racer's eyes, yes. There's a pre-turn to finish off number three at the bottom, approaching rainy curves, and that makes the fourth. Although you could argue that you're kind of out of the corkscrew by then. And that question was asked by Scott Baldwin in an email. I think a commentator had said, you know, there are four apexes. And he was like, really? I personally would have thought there's two. There's a left hand at the top and a right hand at the bottom, but...
Yeah, I'm with you as well, Martin. I've only ridden Laguna a few times, but you know, people tend to count the top of the hill, but that's actually turn seven before you get into the corkscrew. The bottom of it, you know, when you come back across the track for the next turn, I don't call that an apex, but I'd want to see somebody draw it before I argued with them.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been there, but on the PlayStation, I generally have the first apex and then I hit the air fence, and then and everyone goes by as the computer's putting my bike back on the track. And so, yeah, that's an interesting one. Right. Now, we've got some quite topical feedback, because the first piece of feedback was a conversation I got into on Twitter with you, Len.
Yeah, yeah, it was me. I'm not the first one to have this idea, but I was just to give a little bit of a background on this, you know, listening to the commentators for the races, especially the Spanish commentators, that's what I tend to watch live. They tend to get themselves into knots talking about who's riding for points and who's not. And I tend to wildly disagree with them. I think racers race. I think all of the guys out there, especially the guys up front, are trying hard to win. I don't think any of them have the calculator strapped to the top yoke. So I thought it'd be an interesting exercise. And I see that you took it up and you actually did the numbers. You know, how would the championships have turned out if the champion position was based on wins, not just on points?
And except for two, this is that we went back 10 years, which is a nice round figure, and it's also encapsulates the MotoGP era. And it would have made no difference except in 2006, because in 2002, Rossi had 11 wins, no one else came close, then 9, then 9, then 11. And then in 2006, and we all know this was a bit of a strange season, Nicky Hayden had two wins, as did Danny Pedrosa. Melandri had three. Loris Caparossi had 3 and Valentino Rossi had 5, but he crashed out of a load. And I don't think that devalues Nicky Hayden's championship year in any way, shape or form. But it's interesting to note that is the only year it would have made any difference. In 07, Stone had 10 wins. In 08, Rossi had 9. And the next tyres was way, way down. In 09, Rossi only had 6, but still no one else came close to that. In 10, Lorenzo had 9. And in 11, Stoner had 10. Now, there was another question that was an email discussion, and I'm terribly sorry to the listener, and please do write in and refresh me on who it was. They'd argued about whether there are team orders and, you know, who remembers Constructors Championship winners. So incorporated into this table is when has the championship, the Constructors Champion, been a different make than the Riders Champion? And again, it's only in 04, Rossi won the championship on the Yamaha, but the Constructors' Championship went to HRC. Now, it's only that on the Constructors' Championship, it's only the leading riders' points that count. So it doesn't make any difference how many riders you got in there. Whereas the teams, it's obviously how many riders they've got.
And what's interesting in 04 is it was a fairly dominant year for Rossi. I mean, he ran, you know, he won 9 of the races.
Yeah.
But still, Yamaha didn't take all of the points.
No, and looking at that, I have to question whether the Constructors' Championship rules have changed, and it may well have then been an aggregate. The Rossi's teammate that year was Carlos Checa, and HRC was Max Biaggi and Tomada, who were the two HRC riders. So, yeah. But again, basically, whoever, in all but one year, whoever wins the Riders' Championship, that manufacturer will also win the Constructors' Championship. The next bit, if you're happy that we've put that one to bed, so whether you're racing for wins or points, just another point on that. It's interesting you say about the Spanish, because they are very partisan fans, aren't they? Not necessarily in a nationalistic sense, but they're... The Spanish and the Italians, I feel they're purists. They
definitely
want to see the best racing. And I think the Northern Europeans and the Americans were a little bit more pragmatic sometimes. But I definitely feel it was the beginning of the end of British fans' love affair with James Toseland was the 2007 World Superbike Championship, where towards the end of the season, there was a very definite feeling that he was riding conservatively. He wasn't trying to win the race at the slowest possible pace. He was trying to win the championship at the slowest possible pace.
Right.
Okay, you know, there was some luck involved. But I do think Norrie Hager can look back at that season and think, well, if Max Biaggi hadn't wiped me out at, I think it was Monza, then, you know, I'm champion, which, of course, he's never been. You know, what's ifs, buts and maybes. But there is that, it always leaves a slightly bitter taste, doesn't it?
When
when you see someone basically give up trying. But at the same time, we've had situations recently. Danny Pedrosa's perennially being accused of this. And he said there was a race the other day, and he said, you know, I can't remember which race it was. And he said, I could not keep up with Lorenzo. I was going to crash. I was crashing nearly crashing 2 or 3 times a lap anyway. So I thought, well, I better take 20 points, you know, and you can't really argue with that.
But I would want to hear from him and hear him qualify, you know, trying as hard as I can. I think that he was trying as hard as he could without crashing. You know, he certainly didn't want 20 points. He wanted 25.
Yeah, I think it only becomes an issue when it appears to be a race strategy.
Well,
that I'm going to go out and sit in fifth position because I know then I've got, you know, if I must come eighth or above. And again, we can go back to 2006. And I am so looking forward to the first Rossi autobiography after he retires. Maybe we'll find out. Did he really go out into Cheste and get hammered before the Valencia race? Because that's the rumor. And hence why he fell off and Nicky became the champion. But, you know, he only had to come in the top eight.
Oh, yeah.
We all know that he was going to go out to win because that's the character of the man. But
I was there in the corner that he fell down in, and I could not believe it.
No, that must have been my only year in Valencia was the year when Casey Stoner crashed on the warm-up lap.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And that was just bizarre. That was just bizarre. But we'd had the 250 race there, and of course Simoncelli, God bless him, and Hiroshi Ayama were still vying for the finish, and Ayama had run off right underneath. We were sat just above turn one. He'd ran off into the gravel, kept it upright, came back out in 11th, which is exactly where he needed to be. And that was incredibly tense. And then, of course, Simoncelli went and binned it anyway, so it became irrelevant. Now, we do have another piece of email from Nick Codling, but this is about the Valentino Rossi silly season stuff, which we will cover a bit later on. So I think without further ado, we should roll the James Whittam interview, and there's a wrap-up of World Superbikes, and then we'll come back in. Here we go, then. And this is Martin for MotoPod, and once again, James Whittam has very kindly agreed to join us, and we have got a World Superbike race, or two World Superbike races, and a World Supersport race, all of which were as crazy as each other. Overall thoughts of the weekend, James?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it was one of them weekends where if you were a team member, a tyre man, a mechanic, or especially a rider, it was a complete nightmare. There's no question of that. However, if you were a punter or a TV pundit, it was possibly one of the most entertaining weekends racing I've seen for a long, long time. Just because typical British weather, he wouldn't make his mind up what I'm going to do. Tyre choice came into it. People ran up front that you wouldn't consider a front runners. It just had a really sort of exciting feel to it. And I know, as an ex-rider, I'm torn between wanting to see exciting racing and but also not wanting to see anybody get fall off. You know, I don't like to see a load of crashes, but I don't mind seeing a few incidents, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it started in QP, didn't it? We had a front row of Smertz, Kamiya, Gintoli and Haslam, which this season, that's not that common to see those four guys on the front row. Although, I mean, Jakob Smertz does seem to be able to pull out one fast lap.
A lap, yeah. No, I mean, from everything, they didn't really get much of a run at it, which is always a leveler anyway. You know, if Pratchett has mucked about, even if the racing is dry and stable condition-wise, if nobody's had a real good run and got a really good setup and got a tyre that they know is going to work, you know, it does actually level the playing field anyway. But when you get it really mucked about in and out weather-wise through practice and qualifying, not only do you get, you get also mucked up grid where there's people up front you wouldn't necessarily think. There's people like Biaggi coming from the back where they've thrown in practice. And I kind of like the feel to all that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I found amazing, after race one, it starts, we have the crash with Brignola and Johnson at the same time. All the riders put their hands up saying, look, it's raining. So they've stopped it. They go for a restart, declare it a wet race, even though, as you said, and you interviewed Ron Haslam, and the consensus was you've got to go on slicks. And then when they had the shot of the starting grid just before the warm-up, you can clearly see Jakob Smertz is on wet.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking, I don't get it.
I don't get it. The thing is, right, the tyre choice is, yeah, obviously you've got to choose the right tyre, look what the weather's going to do. But the critical point of that is looking what the organisers declare as the race condition. So they declare that first start a dry race. Therefore, they'll stop it if it rains. So you have nothing much to lose by going on slicks because they'll stop it.
Yeah.
If you decide to go on wet and it's declared a dry race, and you know, like Jakob Smertz and Guindoli, well, they're going to stop it anyway because 90% of people's out there on slicks, and they've declared it a dry race. You're not going to benefit from having your wets anyway. Do you know what I mean?
And the point you guys are making that. If it's a drying track, even if it rains, if it doesn't rain in that first lap, by the time you've gone two or three laps, you've destroyed them anyway. So even if it does rain.
Yeah, if you do three laps on a bike with 210 horsepower, right, on wet,
yeah,
you have not got a wet left if it rains.
You're basically running on a carcass then.
Yeah, you've destroyed the middle of the tyre anyway. So, you know, that said, I cannot understand why somebody, having it been declared a dry race, with the experience of Guindoli and Smertz, went on wet. They were never going to benefit from them. You know, however, no. If it's declared a wet race, and they're not going to stop it, and you think it is going to rain pretty soon, well, yeah, you're going to maybe a wet front, intermediate rear, or wet, but they were never going to, they were never going to do anything, having it you know.
And you could see how dodgy. I cannot believe that. I mean, I know that there are some circuits, I believe, where the rumble strips are actually quite grippy.
Yeah.
Clearly not at Silverstone. I mean, Biaggi, that looked like it could have been horrible when he went off with a lap to go. And
to be honest, there is paint available now that has sort of aggregate in it that's supposed to be his grippiest tyre, and I'll tell you what, it's not. And when you, you still have to roll the throttle when you're going onto it, and I can't understand Biaggi, a man of his experience, never even lifted his flipping hand. He just hit it with the throttle pinned, and it was obvious that was going to happen. But I can half understand how Badovini came to do what he did, because, you know, he was right in the mix, going for the line, unsighted, right in the pack, and you can understand why he'd clip a line and, you know, and risk doing that.
And how cool was Johnny Ray? You could almost see his body language like, oh, God, I better put this down now.
Well, that's exactly... Do you know what? I've just been writing for the magazine. I do a column for a magazine. And I said, do you know what? Badovini went down. He's going down, right?
Yeah.
Johnny Ray is trying to avoid the bike by braking hard, realises he's going to hit the bike. His bike's going to go over the top of the fallen BM. The whole lot's going to come down from midair. He's going to smash himself up. The bike's going to get smashed up. So what he does, and to have the presence of mind to do this when things are going wrong all around you, he actually locks the front end and just puts it on the floor as gently as he can. Not only that, he actually held on to the handlebars to stop the thing flipping over and smashing itself to bits. And I tell you, I've tried it, and I've crashed quite a lot, and sometimes I manage it, but to have the presence of mind and the balls when you don't know if you're going to get hit by somebody at 100 mile an hour from behind and smashed to bits or what, that's a brave lad.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, that's a smart lad, isn't it? That is pretty impressive.
It takes a different kind of smart. Everybody knows that's what you should do, but to actually have the arse to do it in the moment it's happening, when you just want to go, help me, you know.
Yeah.
is another thing.
And a word on Loris Baz. I mean, this kid, he's, you know, he lost his ride in BSB because through lack of funding, he was reduced to appealing on Facebook and Twitter for sponsorship.
Help,
He went and did some endurance racing, I believe, and yet he's come back. And now, okay, they were extraordinary circumstances, but he's been looking quick. He was quick at Brno, you know. Yep. What's your feeling?
I've never actually, the jury's out for me. Yeah, he's a good kid. There's no question of that. Yes, his style and his size seem to suit the superbike. I admit that. But everything he's done so far has been iffy or odd conditions. Like Bruno, odd conditions. They started off and it were just not... There were damp patches. And so far, what he's done has been, skillful. And he's done... And he hasn't crashed a lot. And you can't blame him for crashing in... was it race two? Silverstone. I mean, it was that bad. Anybody could have crashed. But I've never seen him show really as strong as that in the dry. And I believe he will do. I think he's good. But so far, he's been helped out by conditions where if you're prepared to stick your neck out and not got a championship to think about, well, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And but you guys made that point there.
That's not to say I don't think he's good. I think he is. I'm not sure how good he's going to be yet. There's no proof yet, if you like.
Yeah, so you need to see some consistency first, I guess.
Yeah.
But race two, very similar conditions, pretty horrendous. The race was called off towards the end. Yeah, I mean, it was turning into carnage. And someone was saying some fuel went down.
Yeah, and I don't know how much fuel went down. The thing is, in the wet, when any kind of fuel or oil goes down, one drop of oil or fuel or puddle 20 metres square, one drop will fill the puddle with kind of, you know, yourself. It spreads out that thin. It might only be one blooming molecule thick, but you do see that kind of oily on water, rainbow kind of effect. And sometimes it ain't that thick because there isn't a lot down, but there was something down. I mean, it should have been stopped anyway, to be honest. You know what they're doing. I mean, they're trying to get the races. It's a bit of a no-win situation for the organisers at that point, because whatever they do, they can't do right. They're trying to get the races done. They're trying to... if they'd have got to two-thirds distance, they'd have put the flags out anyway. That's all they were trying to do. Get it to 12 laps, job done.
But at least with the half points, some of those 0.5s we had might have evened out now.
that's true. From the from Monza. But, you know, what I was thinking, you know, Tom Sykes is going nuts, and I love Tom. Tom's a local lad. He's brilliant. He's having a really good season. I'm pleased for him. But, you know, conditions were worse than that at Nürburgring, and he didn't want it stopped then, did he?
No.
You know, so you've got to be really careful when you start, listening to every single rider's rant, because, and I've been there, and I mean, I know what you do. What riders do is they do whatever's best for them at that point in time, and you can't blame them for doing that. I know at Silverstone in 02 on a super sport bike, I qualified 21st because I had a nightmare through practice. It rained for the race. It was unfit to race, in my opinion. But there's no way, coming through the pack, me going really well in the wet, I was going to ever want it stopped until I got a good position. I just kept going and kept going and kept going and ended up winning it. So what I'm saying is, you know what I mean? It wanted stopping, but there's no way. I was more important was the result than was, you know, me sliding off somewhere.
Yeah, so it's all going to depend on that rider that day.
Exactly.
And there's not
necessarily
going to be any consistency. Fantastic to see Sylvain Guintoli win on the Pata Ducati. I mean, what on earth went on with the Effenberg team with their statement of, well, it's rider performance? I'm thinking, hang on, he's got you a win this season.
It's money. The fact is, it seems to be money. They hadn't paid some of the mechanics, hence they didn't turn up. They were saying one thing in one press release and then another in another, and they couldn't they couldn't prepare a bike for him. Then they said it was down to performance when he, you know, and you thought, well, hang on a minute, he's given him a win and he's by far their best performer really in races.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're saying, yeah, but the rest of the riders pay for their rides and he underperforms for the fact that we're paying him, and I don't know. I had all sorts of crap. But, I mean, end of the day, I think they shot a dosh. And, you know, good riddance from as far as he's concerned, I would have thought. And he's got a team that seemed to like him, have pulled out all the stops to put a bike out that's decent for him. And, you know, he's a good rider. I mean, I don't think he's ever going to be world champ, but he's always going to be winning rounds that are dodgy conditions and running somewhere. You know, he's always going to have rostrums in a year, and he's always going to have, you know, him when... you know, in conditions like he won, because he's brilliant in them.
Absolutely. And then the last controversy was after they red flagged it. Eugene Laverty goes into Parc Fermé, thinks he's third, and then they said, no, actually, they've counted back because some people had crashed the mountain but hadn't been lapped, so they had to go back if what felt like two laps. So Jakob Smerts got reinstated. Is that right?
Right. What the crap was is this, because I found this out. Now then, nobody knows the intricacies of the rules. I read the rule book every year to see if there are any changes, because I need to know and I need to say, you know, if there's a stoppage or whatever. But nobody actually knows in these conditions, because it was quite oddball conditions. Now, what they should do is go back. It says in the rules a last complete lap, which means everybody circulating has done a complete lap. Now, because it was wet and some people, wet conditions are always... polarized people's speeds. Some people are really good in the wet and some people are really crap. And the difference between the good and the bad in the wet is more than the good and the bad in the dry. So there were some people actually a lap behind on the lap that had to be complete for everybody. So they had to go back two laps instead of the last lap that were complete for most. Now,
so that got Baz and Smerts back into it.
Well, right. What it is, at the point at which the red flags go out, right?
Yep.
This is how I would explain it. At the point at which the red flags go out, if you took a picture from 1,000 foot up, right?
Yep.
Whoever was on their bike and circulating, regardless of if they've been off, if they were on their bike and circulating, even if they've crashed, they will count in the result, wherever they take it back to get the last complete lap for everybody.
Got you.
So the fact is, if you got back on, then they counted you where you were the two laps before you fell off or the race was stopped. And that's what happened.
It sounded initially like Aprilia were going to make a complaint, and then Eugene later was saying, very philosophical about it, just said, no, it's just one of those things. There was a bit of
confusion. It is one of those things. And you know, the rule thing, it seemed a bit arbitrary to me, but it's not, they didn't do it to give anybody any advantage or to be, you know, it's fairly impartial. It just happens it's going to work for some and not for others. And next time that happens, if it ever does, it might work for Eugene and not for Smertz. You know, you don't know, do you? But it was odd. And the fact was, nobody really seemed to know what was going on. You know, it's a bit of an oddball. It happened almost the same at Mallory when there was a big wipeout with Simon Andrews leading and Josh Brooks crashed and wiped 15 people out and the hairpin, and some got back on, some didn't, and then there was this time limit where if you didn't get back on your bike and back to pits within 5 minutes of the crash, which is all a little bit, who knows, who's on the bike or who isn't, because it isn't a picture taken from space, it's just on some, who knows exactly when the red flag went out, if somebody around the back of the circuit were going, if a marshal doesn't, it's just weird.
There's but, always going to be some subjectivity in it, isn't there?
I don't know. At the end of the day, it was just a weird ending to it, and it was going to work for some and not for others.
And then we had World Supersport, which was, well, obviously in between the two superbike races, that was crazy as well. And we had the start, the stop, the restart, and Clouzel doing a very good stalking job on Sam Lowe's.
Those
two guys did go. Keenan seemed off colour.
He did, and to be honest, he did most of the weekend, and I really don't know why. I spoke to him on the grid, and he said, because I spoke to him because he were on the third row.
Yeah.
And he just says, look, I love the place, but I've never won here, and I'll love it a lot more if I win. And even in his voice as he's saying that, you're thinking, it's a weird thing to say. You know, it's just, he didn't seem 100% positive like he normally is. So I don't know. I mean, you can never write the dude off. I think he's very, very good. Regardless of whether you like him as a person or he rides, you know, he's always going to be a championship contender just because how he is.
Closed it up a bit, hasn't it? I mean, Sam's 14 points behind.
Yeah, I'll tell you who's a kid there, you know. I mean, I know he likes Silverstone because he's gone well there. He's won a Moto2 round, but Clouzel was class there.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, I think Clouzel probably at Silverstone, and this isn't everywhere, but at Silverstone, Clouzel probably had the drop on Lowe's as far as times go. I think he possibly was the faster man on the day.
Yeah.
But you know Lowe's will try and sort of muscle him in, you know, and rough him up, and you know Lowe's will have a go and push it. But on that occasion, Clouzel kind of out-toughed him, you know, and that was a shock to me. Even if you're not just as quick as somebody, if you can stay with them and kind of batter him into submission somewhere, I've won races like that, you know. You know, Fourier was always really, really quick, but if you could just stay with him and keep messing him up and putting him off his stride and making him make mistakes and then frying him, you could beat him. And I think Lowe's had let it, Clouzel had a plan, put his plan into action, and I think Lowe thought, do you know what, I'll just fucking bat him out of the way and make him surrender here. And he wasn't having it. And that was a big shock.
We're off to Moscow next. Now, that's going to be interesting. Are you going out there?
Yep.
Are you looking forward to it?
Yep.
Do you know much about it?
No. I don't know. No. The good part about it is nobody knows anything about it. Which is, you know, for my money, that's absolutely brilliant. It's just brilliant. I like the idea of, you know, a level playing field. People like Dan Linford, who's just into the series now, into the Super Sport series, and on the back foot because of that, you know, they're going to go there with a, you know, really good chance of anybody else. So I like it when it's a new circuit. I always did when I race, I thought, well, yeah, I'd like to get my teeth stuck into this when everybody else is doing the same. Instead of arriving somewhere where, you know, half a dozen teams have spent in quid testing, you know.
And Marco Melandri only 10.5 points behind Biaggi now. So that is getting tight.
Yeah, and I hate to say this because I'd probably rather see Viaggio in it than Melandre, just because the way Melandre's kind of he ain't got a lot of respect for people, you know, on track, and that kind of
yeah.
he consistently pulls hard moves, and I kind of I don't know whether I like that or not, you know. Yeah, you've got to go for it.
I heard an opinion. This was just a mate we were chatting that. The coming from MotoGP, because I remember when Biaggi came across when he was first on that sterile guard of Ducati, and he was like, "Oh, sorry, on the Corona Suzuki course."
That's right.
And he was like, "Yeah, okay, these guys play a bit rough. If that's the way they like it, I can do that as well," sort of thing. So I wonder if he's sort of come across with this attitude of World Superbikes. That's where they bash fairings. I better do some of that. And actually, they're not doing it that much. And he's the one who's worse than everyone else. I don't know.
Yeah, he ain't making any friends. And I don't, consistently, I don't, when I raced, I didn't, you know, I'd ride hard, but I don't think I rode unfair of it, you know, and you never did him apologise for any moves, and had done it, and he must have done, you know, seasons worth of dodgy moves there, you know, and.
Yeah.
So I've kind of gone away from liking him a little bit, you know, I mean, I still respect him. I actually do think he's probably got the momentum to win championship, though.
Yeah, and of course the other thing is silly season in MotoGP is again is crossing over to World Superbikes.
Yeah,
strong rumor that Ben Spies is coming to join Marco in the BMW
exactly,
team next
yeah.
year, but it
yep.
won't be full factory. Maybe with a view to them both going back to MotoGP a year or two later.
Yeah,
Leon seems to be tipped to join Johnny Ray.
He does, yeah, or even Johnny Ray heading for Gresini MotoGP, or
yeah.
there's all sorts of crap. The rumour mill's in sort of top gear, but strong rumour is Spies to Goldbet, or let's certainly say BMW Italia. They're talking about Dovizioso possibly World Superbike.
I mean, he said that himself, hasn't he? If I can't have a factory bike in MotoGP, I might look at another series.
Yeah.
And of course, this strong rumour now that almost seems, it's looking like there'll be an announcement next Wednesday that Rossi's going back to Yamaha.
That's a done deal, I've heard.
Yeah, and the rumour is that he's going to be 2 years on the MotoGP with an option to extend if they both like it. If not, possibly go to World Superbikes with
him. On a new R1, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, they're talking about the new R1 in 2014, Rossi joining in 2015, having had some say in development. I mean, that would give a massive... I mean, that could be a real smack between the eyes for Dorna if he moves across, because he brings attention.
Absolutely. The problem I can see for Superbike is they're now committed, so I'm told, to continuing with the current set of engine regs and regulations, let's say, for regs.
Yeah.
And for me, the problem isn't going to be getting riders in the championship. The problem's going to be getting factory or, you know, decent teams to have the riders out there.
Yeah.
There's going to be two less BMs out there next year. You know, Effenberg are always saying that they're going to be flipping, going somewhere else or not doing it, or they haven't got any money anyway. So, I don't...
Yeah, and I've got to say, looking at Silverstone, it's a big wide track. Looking at that grid, four abreast, it did look a bit like MotoGP last year when
exactly.
we were down. It looked a bit thin on the ground. Which...
Exactly. You got mid-20s tops, you know, low 20s. And once you get below sort of 22, 23, for me, for a world championship, it's... So, I don't know whether... You know, it's all right, everybody wanting to come, but whether that'll bring the manufacturer involvement, I have no idea, because for me, that's what it needs. It needs, you know, it's a blow that BMW are leaving, put it that way.
No, absolutely. James, I won't keep you any longer. Thanks ever so much for your thoughts yet again on World Superbike. Good, best of luck in Moscow. Really looking forward to seeing how that one goes.
Yeah.
And we will speak to you again very soon.
Cheers, Martin.
Thanks very
mate.
Much. Cheers,
Cheers
James. So once again, a great thanks to James Whittam. It is fantastic listening to his commentary and then being able to get him on the show. And he's always such a willing interviewee. That was really good. We've spoken about a fair amount with James. One thing we didn't cover then was this business. And Johnny Ray was quite annoyed after race one with the tyre warmer call, the 3 minutes call, which is get your tyre warmers off. And according to Johnny, Max Biaggi's bike and Marco Melange's bike didn't even have wheels on at that stage. And you were saying then you've seen something on Twitter about this.
Well, yeah, I heard somebody say that I think it was Melandri that had been handed a fine, you know, since he hadn't been levied any sort of a penalty at the meeting. You know, you can't go back and do anything about it now, but he'd been given a fine, which I'm sure he's okay with. I'm sure he's willing to pay 2,000 or 3,000 euros to get whatever advantage they did by making their decision late.
Yeah, because obviously the point there is they can look. I mean, the big thing, if anyone watched the Eurosport coverage with Jack and James, they were saying, you know, you basically – all the championship contenders want to go on the same tire as everyone else. So they're leaving to the last minute. They're making sure they're going out on slicks. And as James said, bizarre decision by Jakob Smerts and Sylvain Guintoli to go out on wets on a rapidly drying track. Yes, it was. I mean, it was really hairy. It was like watching guys. It was like ice riding for the first few laps. Then they got into it. And then, of course, it started to rain again. Bloody British weather.
Yeah, it was some kind of crazy race. It really was.
Yeah, and then race two was pretty much the same. I mean, at least it started wet and stayed wet.
But at least, it was full wet and they were on wets.
Yeah, and then, and again, James mentioned this thing that there was fuel or oil was put down. He said, and in wet conditions, you only need a couple of molecules, and it will spread across the track. And as soon as the riders see, and we've all seen it before, you know, you ride along a wet road on your bike. And you see that strip of rainbow where someone's laid some bloody diesel down, and it's just, oh man.
And you know,
really, really dodgy. And as soon as they see that, of course, hands are going up. It's like, no, we know it's raining. You know, this is something worse.
But this is too much.
So again, we've ended up with half points. World Super Sport was just as crazy as we discussed. You know, that was another start stop. Masterful ride by Jules Cluzel.
Yeah, I think he really had the measure of lows in this race. You could tell, and they were even riding completely different. You know, Jules looked like he was on a 250, taking these big, beautiful, sweeping lines that, you know, Silverstone just begs for.
Yeah,
and Lowe's was really running it in tight, almost like he was riding a superbike, and you could see the difference. You could see the difference in the entrances, you know, mid corner speed, all of it, and I think it worked for Jules in the end.
I mean, it was funny. I actually sat at Silverstone in the media center. Listening to the opinions of Julian Ryder and Dennis Noyes and Neil Spaulding and all these, and David Emmett, all these experts, and I'm sitting there soaking it up so I can pretend they're my thoughts when we do the next podcast. And one point they made was the small capacity bikes on a wide sweeping circuit like that just always makes for fantastic racing. You know, and we saw the variation of lines people can take in Moto 3 and in Moto 2 particularly, and we saw it again with the World Supersport. And it's just strange though, as James mentioned, Keenan off colour. You know, love him or hate him, he is a great rider, but he is getting caught. The momentum seems to be with Sam Lowes and Jules Cluzel.
I think so. Well, look at the whole front row. It was all those PTR bikes there. The bikes are fast. The riders are fast. You know, they've got a program that's working for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And those teams seem pretty – there doesn't seem to be like the old days of Tenkata would just, you know, dominate World Supersport. We've got Brock there, but the teams, PTR and Bogdanka, they seem to be very similarly matched. With Tenkata as well. And it's good seeing the old veterans like Brock Parks and Fabien Ferré still up and knocking about with these young kids. And Gabor Talmashi.
Gabor was there. Yeah. He didn't do too badly, but I was really impressed with Brock Parks. He qualified really poorly. He was back, I think it was in 18th. And both in the first start and in the restart, he jumped up front. He was up in sixth place by the end of the first lap.
Yeah.
And then finishing, I think he finished third on the podium, which is just fantastic.
That was one point that James Ritter made, that, you know, Tom Sykes raging after he'd crashed that the race should have been stopped. Then, of course, he got reinstated because of the count back, but he didn't know that was going to happen at the time. And he said, but the funny thing is, if he'd been leading, he wouldn't have wanted it stopped. And you know, racers will want what they want. But he did make the point that the difference between the very good dry riders and the very bad dry riders is less than the very good wet riders and the very poor wet riders, you know, and you will get these anomalies and you will get the pack spread out. And he said, and if you're good in the wet, a bad qualifying position isn't that much of a handicap, because you can cut through and do really well. Ronan Kwambi also got a fourth place, just off the podium. But, you know, it's good to see that there's some of the new faces appearing. Well, he's not that new, but...
relatively new on the world circuit. And it looks like they're growing good talent down in South Africa between him and Sheridan Marais, you know, a really good pair of riders.
And of course, we got Brad Binder in Moto3, who's really looking like he's got some promise. Jules spoke to him at Bonneau and, you know, interviewed him for the show. And he said he's such a nice kid, but he's also such a smart kid. Mm-hmm. Reminded me of the early days of Bradley Smith, where there's this little carrot-topped 15-year-old school kid who speaks with the words of you know, a 25-year-old seasoned racer.
Yeah, well, these kids grow up fast, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a normal life. And you look at Casey Stoner's experience, you know, his whole family move halfway around the world, and he's living out of a caravan, you know, age 14. That is dedication.
Yeah, had to wake up half an hour before he went to sleep, all of that. Poor guy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the reason they are where they are is because they bloody earned it.
Definitely. You know, the other thing that really jumped out at me from the races this weekend was the performance of the Suzukis, especially Camier.
Yes.
They've been nowhere, and I don't know if it's the new Les Pearson engine or what it is, but all of a sudden it was working for them. Not so much for Hopkins, but definitely for Camier.
Yeah, I mean, John Hopkins, I think it's for him to have turned himself around the way he did. I still look back and think, why did he go to Kawasaki? You know, if he'd stayed with Suzuki, I just think possibly his whole life might have turned out so differently. But he goes to Kawasaki, you know, he goes off the rails himself, gets himself back on it. He's earned some good luck, and he just gets nothing. And we know the kid's good. He's the youngest rider in MotoGP ever to get to 100 starts. You know, okay, it's not wins, it's just starts. But, you know, John Ulrich picked this kid out for a reason. He is super talented, and it just seems he can't quite find a bike and a circumstance and a team with which he can get the best out of himself.
Yeah, it's too bad. It really seems like there's something there, but it just doesn't ever all come together at the same time.
Yeah, and you know, I say time's running out for him. Hang on a sec. Let's have a look at Max Biaggi and Carlos Checa. Yeah, he's got a couple of decades left. But, you know, it's crazy. And speaking of the old horses, as I mentioned to James, silly season is crossing series. We've got an awful lot. I mean, everyone now knows that Ben Spies has announced he won't be with Yamaha next year. It appears certainly James confirmed that it's pretty much an open secret he will be joining Marco Melandri at BMW next year. But of course, it won't be the factory BMW, it'll be BMW Italia, so they're dropping down to two bikes, and that grid looked thin.
It looked I remember specifically counting, and I think there was 24 maybe bikes on the grid.
Problem is, of course, because they go four abreast for the start on the grid, it looked like MotoGP last year, and we're down to 16, 17 bikes.
It just
looks thin, and we're like, you know, we mentioned this possibility, and we'll come on to the Rossi speculation that it may be if he does go back to Yamaha, and it pretty much seems that is a done deal, that he'll have 2 years in MotoGP, then we'll have the option of going across to World Superbikes, possibly a year after Yamaha re-enter. So in 2014, they re-enter World Superbike on it with a new R1. He has some development input, goes across in 2015 to try and become the first person to ever win both championships. Now, I don't know if that will happen or not, but he's often expressed, he said it looks fun. I suspect Max will retire at the end of 2014 if that seems to be going to be happening. But I don't know if he's going to want to go across if the series seems to be withering.
Yeah, I think it'll depend on the state of the series, like you said. I mean, everybody says, you know, who knows what the story really is, but everybody says that he's very mindful of his position in history. So maybe that is something that's attractive to him. But a question for you, Martin. I know that you went to Superbike this year up in England. Had you been before, or was that the first time?
No, in fact, I've not made a World Superbike race this year. I got to Alton Park for the BSB.
Ah, okay. Because I went to a World Superbike race for the first time ever this year. You know, been going to GPs forever.
Yeah.
But I went, since there was one here, I went. And it was great racing. And it was, but I have to say, the paddock wasn't impressive. It really did feel like one of the more important national series. It felt like you were at an AMA or a BSB race.
Well, some people like that because it is an open, friendly paddock. I mean, when I was going to Donington to watch World Superbike races, I've been there a few times. I was a listener, fan of Motopod then, or MotoGPOD as it was. Sorry, Dorna, I'll take the G out. Moto bleep POD. But so I didn't have any kind of paddock access. But certainly, it is a different atmosphere. It's the old story. If you want to see the best racing, go and watch your local club race. If you want to see the best racers, you watch MotoGP.
Yeah, there you go.
I should enjoy World Superbikes more because the racing's often closer. I don't. I love it, but I'm not. It just doesn't quite give me that absolute thrill buzz of MotoGP. And I know there's plenty of fans who disagree with me who absolutely love World Superbikes and British Superbikes or AMA, and they're kind of MotoGP, oh, it's boring, it's processional and all that, and I think it is at times, but this season I think it's been really good.
I think even when it's processional, I mean, and I read a great article today about somebody who was, you know, rebutting people saying that it was boring and that it was terrible.
Yeah.
Even when it's processional, you know, because at Laguna there was a one pass.
Yeah.
Which was Casey getting in front of Lorenzo. Yeah. But it was a study in contrasts, watching those two guys ride and how both styles can be just as effective and just as fast as each other. I really challenge anybody to say it's boring even when there aren't passes. It's incredible to watch these guys ride. But then again, you know, I come from a position that I do go to club races, and I think all racing is just fantastic. You know, having, you know, like Mark, who is it? Mark Martin says, you know, my shitty little world of racing. Well, mine was even shittier.
Mark Miller, yeah.
Mark Miller.
Yeah.
Mine was shittier and littler, but yeah. But it leaves me with just an incredible appreciation for these guys.
Yeah, I mean, I have friends who are Formula One fans, and they're passionate about Formula One, but they still set an alarm to wake up in case they drop off after their Sunday dinner. Five laps before the end, and I'm right. Like, this is your passion, and you still go to sleep. It's because it goes on too long. But I mean, I've said to them, because they've said, oh, we had more overtakes in this weekend's Formula One race than you did in MotoGP or whatever, and I don't care. I could watch Casey Stoner go round lap after lap after lap on his own.
Yep.
And I just, the way he defies gravity and the laws of physics, I find it astounding. When I got a track bike, I got an R6 because I'm not interested in just straight line speed for itself. What I love, and this is why Alton Park's a brilliant track to be the closest one for me, because I just love putting those corners together and all that and getting my knee down. And to, in my head, my shitty little world of racing is the only world of racing for that, you know, for that day.
Yep.
And then I watch these guys and I think, oh my God, I'm doing the same thing as them, but so far removed from their level that it is like, you know, I'm on a trampoline and they're walking on the moon. You know, it's that kind of difference. And yeah, and as well, even if the racing is boring, it seems to kind of even out. Well, not boring, but even if the racing isn't wheel-to-wheel ding-dong, which this season I think we've been really spoiled. We've had some brilliant races.
I think it's been great, yeah.
But the championship becomes its own race, and I just, you know, the ins and outs that the people get an injury or people just off colour at one race and it changes. And we saw, you know, Lorenzo gets wiped out by Bautista at Assen. It's like, oh my goodness, that's it. You know, all the momentum's with Casey. Then he crashes out at Sachsenring at the very next race, and no, Lorenzo's back out in front, and Danny's doing a stealth job. He's now in second place. You know, yep. I think those sorts of things are amazing.
Yeah, yeah. The race behind the race is also very good.
Yeah, exactly. And it's I absolutely accept why some people may prefer BSB, AMA, World Superbike. For me, it just hasn't quite got the hook. But that's not to say I don't love it. I do. And, you know, I would love watching it. An interesting point as well about silly season, just before we go on to the Rossi thing that James mentioned. I said there is I've heard a rumor that Leon Haslam may well be going to Tenkata. Hiroshi Ayama doesn't seem to have got on with that bike or the circuits or whatever, and to join Johnny Ray. And James came straight back and said, yeah, unless Johnny Ray's going to Cressini. And it is worth pointing out the importance that the Japanese manufacturers put on Suzuka 8-hour. Johnny Ray was the first Brit to be in a winning team. Let's not say he won it, because he was with two other riders, both Japanese. And I can't remember, Aoki, I think, and I can't remember his other teammate. But that is a massive thing for the Japanese riders. And that to them is probably like the TT to us. You know, if we suddenly had Ben Spies turn up and win the TT, we'd be like, oh my god, you know. Well, to the Japanese, that's what it's like, I think.
Yeah.
So that is a possibility. Whether he'd be an improvement over Alvaro Bautista, whether Fausto Grissini wants a British rider or an Irish rider, I don't know.
Interesting, because he's said already a few times that, you know, he needs an Italian rider to sell those potato chips, is what it comes down to.
He does, unless those potato chip colors are going to be deserting them and going to Yamaha factory, which is another rumor
I've heard today. There you go. Okay.
Another mate has said let's do the Rossi thing. There was a story broke. Supposedly Neil McKenzie, former BSB and MotoGP or 500 GP racer, had tweeted that he saw Rossi coming out of Yamaha Europe's HQ. David Emmett, in all good faith, repeated this. It went viral over Twitter. Then Neil McKenzie came out and went, it wasn't me. So it was either someone pretending to be him, or, as Jim said, he's thinking it was his account, but it had been hacked or cracked. Now the latest rumor is actually it was Neil McKenzie. He did do it himself, then thought, damn, they might not like me saying that, particularly as he's trying to get his son a ride with Yamaha. And so he said, no, my account's been hacked, or it wasn't me, it was a spoof account. But anyway, the story broke. Since then, it's been in Solomoto in Spain. It's been in Gazzetta dello Sport in Italy that it's a done deal. It will be announced next Wednesday. Rossi's going to Yamaha factory team. And of course, the big thing then is what sponsor's going to come with him. Mate of mine heard Nissan, but I'm not sure where he heard that from. And Neil Spaulding made a very good point on Twitter that Yamaha are very close with Toyota. Not that he's suggesting Toyota might be a sponsor, although they have just got their number one car sales position in the world back. But then this story broke that maybe Toyota, who are a personal sponsor of Rossi's, would get involved. And the other one was San Carlo.
Interesting.
Hard to say. That would leave Grissini and Tectoire possibly a bit loose. And I'm not sure what Tectoire Monster's contract is, how long it runs for. You've also, of course, got Lorenzo, who is advertising Rockstar as a personal sponsor. So whether, and it's another energy drink, so I can't see Monster agreeing to sponsor the team. So maybe they're just going to have Rossi some money. I mean, when he had Monster last time, we had Lorenzo with Grizzly Bear or Grizzly Drinks, whatever, you know. So who can tell? But it should be good news for Yamaha. Let's face it, for 2 years, have not had a title sponsor.
Yeah, well, they definitely need something. I have to say, a question that I'd put to you, Martin, is are you willing to watch the racing and concentrate on the racing and forget about silly season for the rest of the season?
Forget about silly season.
Yeah. Or do you like it?
It is what it is. I think you can't avoid it. And even though we want to concentrate on, I think the sooner it's done, the reason I'm talking about it, the reason I want to know is because I want to know what's going to happen next year. Then we can put that to bed and stop thinking about next year and concentrate on the racing this season. And I totally take your point that it is a massive distraction. But it happens every year,
and it's
going to continue to happen. And I don't think there's a way of avoiding it, particularly when we're talking about, I mean, it did look initially that, you know, I mean, Casey Stoner announces his retirement. 2 weeks later, Lorenzo announces that he's staying for another 2 years with Yamaha. if at that stage Rossi said, yeah, an Audi are coming in, I'm going to stay with Ducati for 2 years, I think that would have been it done.
Well, that would have really quieted things down, certainly.
And okay, Ben throws in his spanner of, I'm not actually going to be in the paddock next year. Well, he hasn't said that. He said he's leaving Yamaha, which immediately made people think, oh, Suzuki coming back early. But no, it rather looks like he's going to crop back across the World Superbikes. That would have caused a rupture, some ripples, but I think it's the Rossi thing. We need to get the Rossi thing sorted out. Then it will be, and you've got to feel sorry for Dovi. And actually, a very good point made. I was saying Dovi might be best staying where he is, because if he can be close to or possibly beat Rossi on a satellite Yamaha when Rossi's on a factory Yamaha, surely that makes his case. Having said that, Rossi's going to sign a 2-year contract minimum, I'm sure, so it doesn't really help him get into the factory Yamaha team. And then Beth Andrews on Twitter made a very good point that actually, if Dovi did go to Ducati, which is another rumour, and did better than Rossi, well, how good does that make him look?
True. And we know Dovi's fast. You know, when he first came, you know, he beat Rossi in a straight up fight at Qatar a couple of years ago.
Yeah, when he was on the Interwetten, was it? The Scott Racing.
The JIR Scott Honda, exactly.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to wonder, going to Ducati is a big gamble until they prove themselves.
Yeah.
Staying close to Yamaha, I think, is really his only viable route to a good factory ride, because, you know, he burned the bridge at Honda. They're never going to take him back.
Well, there was a rumor that Grassini might be tempted, but his relationship with Honda may not be the strongest at the moment anyway.
Right.
And that may not help matters. No, because I don't think HRC will want, after Dovi forced them to keep him.
Exactly.
I don't think they'll want anything to do with him. It is worth, I think, possibly, I did mention him earlier, Nick Codling's email. And I'll just quote what Nick said. He said, I just want to say, as a long-term Rossi fan, I'd actually be disappointed to the extent of him seriously going down in my estimation if he jumped ship. He says, Nick goes on to say, he doesn't know what's gone on behind the closed doors at Ducati. And obviously there have been problems there, but he thinks it would be a corporate disaster for Ducati to lose Rossi. But it does seem like they're going to. I think that the point that Nick's making, and this is something that a few people have started to say, Nick used the phrase, changing now will be like the kid who always follows the football team that's winning. I don't think it's so much that, but it does kind of undermine the whole rant at HRC thing back in 2004. You know, they say it's all about the bike. I'm proving it's not. It's all about the rider. Well, it looks like it's a bit of both.
Yeah, I think so. It's all about the rider if you've got the right base conditions.
Yeah. And I've heard a few people saying, and I don't know if these are habitual Rossi bashers, but they're, and let's face it, there aren't many of those. You know, people saying he's, yes, of course he's a brilliant rider, but maybe he's just been really lucky and or clever and ridden the crest of a great bike. I mean, there was some idiot on Twitter the other week and got in this massive rant that Lorenzo's nothing. You know, he's done is jumped on a bike that was made for him. I'm thinking, well, so did lots of other people. And sorry. Rossi seems able to give massive respect to Jorge Lorenzo. Rossi's fans, a very few of his fans seem to find it more difficult. And there's this whole thing about, you know, it's his bike, the M1, or the 800 M1 was. I was like, well, no, it's Yamaha's, actually.
Yeah, I think all you've got to do is listen to Rossi when he's been talking about the development of the Ducati. He says, hey, it's the rider's job to give feedback, and the engineers make the bike.
Yeah, yeah.
And exactly. I think you could say the same thing about the Yamaha. It's Furusawa's bike.
Yes. And the other point as well is, okay, obviously the DNA of the 1000cc M1 is very closely related to the 800, but it is a new bike. Bottom up, it is a new bike. So I hope that all these blinkered Rossi fans, if he does have any success on it, are going to give kudos back to Ramon Fachada and Jorge Lorenzo.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, we all know that these guys use different setups, even if they're riding the same bike.
Yeah.
And obviously, what Ramon and Jorge have done has been fantastic. You know, look at the way the guy rides. Look at the races that he wins. You know, just an incredible talent there.
And it's certainly true that last season people were saying, you know, the one rider who may struggle on the Thau is going to be Lorenzo, because the 800 was so close to a 250 in the required riding style, all the smooth corner speed stuff. And no, he's absolutely taken to it. I mean, Cal Crutchlow's had some brilliant quotes where people have asked him, you know, do you get to see other people's data? He said, yeah, we all share. Yeah, I get to see Lorenzo's data. Sometimes I wish I hadn't.
Exactly, because all he has to do is wonder how does he do that?
Yeah, I mean, he said about he said he breaks earlier, but less.
And rolls it through, yeah.
Yeah, and it is just incredible. So it does look like by the time you guys hear this, we're going to be a couple of days away from Valentino being announced as a Yamaha rider for next year. Be interesting to see if Ducati repay the favor and let him test at Valencia. I suspect they will.
Yeah, I can't see that they wouldn't, especially since they were the beneficiaries of Yamaha letting him do the same.
Yeah, exactly. And interestingly, there seems to be the word from Italy is that there's a split in the fans, that the nailed on Ducatisti are angry with Rossi because he's ruined Ducati's reputation. And the Rossi fans are furious with Ducati because they've ruined Rossi's reputation. So I think it's going to be difficult. And it definitely, it undermines the legend a little bit, the fact that he hasn't been able to make it work. But I think from Rossi's point of view, he just wants to win again or have a realistic chance of winning again.
I think so. But I have to... But, you know, I try not to be a fan of the mark or of the rider. You know, I love racing, and I'll watch any of these guys race. But I really wonder, you know, after Rossi broke his leg, after he had what must have been a terrible psychological thing to go through,
yeah.
Those things take a toll. And you and I know this, Martin, the older we get, the more those things, you know, the more things weigh on you. When you're young, yeah. You're immortal and nothing bothers you. The older you get, the more things affect you. And not to say that all of that has been a knock on Rossi and that he's not going to come back from him.
Yeah.
But he is human.
Yeah. And I mean, it's been well documented that PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder in soldiers, it can affect to a degree everybody, but it can have far more profound and lengthy effects on older people, particularly when they have families. Which obviously Rossi doesn't, but, you know, this comes back to the Casey question. You think it's not any one thing, as he said himself. It's just a combination of things, mainly that he just isn't enjoying it as much anymore. But I think being a father does make a difference. And I think when you're a teenager or in your early 20s, you can put things in a box and leave it. But one day you're going to take them out of that box and examine them again. And the more boxes you collect, the more difficult it gets to find storage space where they don't come in and affect you every day.
Exactly. I'm
torturing this analogy here.
No, but it is true. The denial game gets harder to play the older you get, is what it comes down to.
Yeah. The other bit of the Rossi thing that came out, of course, was the Masao Furuzawa went to Italy, was known to have gone to Italy. Everyone's saying, wow. And this was a couple of weeks ago, and it looked like all the opinion was swinging back. Rossi's going to stay because Furuzawa's gone to Italy. He wouldn't have gone there if he was going to say no. And some of the Japanese media have been saying, yes, he would. It's polite. He's gone there. Said, thank you very much for your offer of employment in a consultancy role, but no. And they'd all been predicting he'd say no because he's a Yamaha man through and through. However, I wonder what will happen if Yamaha say to him, we know you're retired, but... You know, you did that little bit of consultancy for us after you officially retired. Do you want to do that again? And I wonder if the draw of Rossi back at Yamaha would prove too much for Ozawa to resist. And then, of course, will Rossi get his team to go with him? I cannot imagine he would happily go unless Joey Burgess and Alex Briggs and the Aussies and the Italians and the Japanese go with him. In fact, sorry, he hasn't got any Japanese where he is now. But, you know, if he doesn't take that tight crew with him, that is going to be interesting. And I suspect he knows they'll go.
Yeah, they all seem like such a, you know, like such a tight bunch.
It's a family, aren't they, really?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine them not going, you know, because what do they have, you know, what's there for them at Ducati?
With Jerry Burgess, I think that there's three ways he can go. He can either retire. And let's face it, he's earned it. of course he can go back to Yamaha with Rossi, and I suspect that's the most likely outcome. But I wonder if he might be tempted to say, well, hang on, I want to make this work. I want to show that, because I think a lot of people have forgotten, or they're younger fans, and they don't remember that Jerry Burgess was the wizard with Mick Doohan. You know, he worked with Doohan for years and was seen as just as an integral part of Mick Doohan's success as he has been with Rossi's. So I wonder if Jerry's thinking, maybe I want to see if I can do it with someone else.
There could be some unfinished business there for him. But
yeah,
for me, from, you know, and again, completely from the outside, it just it seems like it's a tense situation. And I just wonder if he really feels like there's anything for him to do there.
Yeah. And it may not feel that happy a place after the 2 years they've had, or will have had by the end of the season, and without Rossi there. Yeah, no, I suspect he's going back. I suspect he's going back.
Well, going back or going home, because, you know, he's got a wife that was, you know, sick a few years ago, and maybe he, you know, maybe that's going to pull on him a little more too. Who knows?
Yeah. But it'd be fascinating. So by next week's show, we should know. Oh. But interesting timing as well. And this was a point made by David Emmett, that it's quite common they do this. Because if you think about it, an awful lot of the bike racing press will be in aircraft flying to Indianapolis when the announcement's made.
Oh, that's
so they
true.
Can put it out there with a little bit of peace and quiet. So, you know, if anyone's out there early, or, you know, or anyone's still in Europe, or the Europe, waiting to go across there, then, you know, that could be interesting.
We'll have to see. The sooner that comes out, the sooner the reality show is over.
Absolutely. And incidentally, if anybody wants to see that, I just put together a little thing, which I've been playing around in my mind for ages, a little thing on YouTube about Rossi. It's just set to music, and it's just my take on it. For those of you who still view me as a blinkered Lorenzo fan who can't say anything good about Valentino, it is not in any way a piss take. It really isn't. But if you go to YouTube and search for VR46, what if? I think five dots and a question mark. If you just put VR46, what if? Or go to Martin Darlington, search Martin Darlington, and you'll find my account. And it's one of two videos there. And have a look. And if you like it. 389 people have viewed it or something. There's four likes and one dislike. So, but there'll be a link to that in the show notes. And I've got to say, oh, bless him, Jules did a fantastic job plugging this walk. And I know I took the mickey at the beginning of the show. That was just to annoy Jim and Jules. And I'm going to do the edit. So it's just going to hopefully go straight to Jules or Jim to put up on iTunes later this week. It's Swansea, Welshpool and Carnarvon. It was the pronunciation of Carnarvon. Welsh is not an easy language.
Yeah, it's not spelled that way, Martin. Are you sure it says Carnarvon?
Yeah.
Okay.
A single F in Welsh is a V sound. A double F is a soft F.
Okay.
It's pronounced Carnarvon. Swansea is it's, well, it's Swan C.
It looks like it sounds, yeah.
With a hard S, so it's Swansea. Yeah, and that goes a week on Friday. So by the time you listen to this, I'll be into my last week of not having feet that are battered and bruised. It's basically a marathon a day for 8 days.
Yeah, how's the training going?
Yeah, training's been really good, actually. I've done a number. I haven't yet done, well, I'm not going to now, the full distance of a day's walk, as in 26 to 28 miles of the averages each day. But I've been doing 20 milers, and I tried out a new pair of trainers last week, and a couple of people might have seen this. This was put up on the Facebook fan page of finding out if tinct benzene or compound of benzene tincture, as this one calls itself, it's a solution we used to use in the army to treat blisters. It's incredibly painful, but it does turn raw blister lower skin into hard outer skin in about 30 seconds. But you pay for it in pain. And I tried out a new pair of trainers, did 10 miles in them, got a load of blisters, thought, okay, I'm not wearing those again. Got back into my boots and had to do another 10 miles of them because I had to prove to myself that I could still walk on blisters. And it's not, once you get going, it's not that bad. But if you stop for a water break or a vent break for a couple of minutes, the first sort of 30 yards when you start again are just horrible. But anyway, the website, we over £4,000 now is coming in donations. There'll be a load of events during the walk. And you can find out all about it at www.walk-on.co.uk. That's walk-on.co.uk, which will immediately redirect people to a Welsh language website. Cerdyn Ymlaen is, if I say it quickly enough, then any Welsh speaking listeners may forgive me that pronunciation. So don't worry if you're immediately redirected to something you can't understand or pronounce. Neither can I. But that's got all the details on there. So there'll also be a link to that in the show notes. And a look forward. What have we got coming up? We've got Indianapolis. Nothing this coming weekend. Then Indianapolis the week after. I will be walking from Glenneath to, no, from Bilth Wells to Llandrindod Wells on the day of the race. So I'm going to hope we get there before, I think it's on about 7 o'clock. Indianapolis will be 5. That's Eastern Seaboard time, isn't it?
It's Central time. So it'll be, for me it's 7, for you at 6 hours.
8. No, you're ahead of me.
Yep.
So the race is at 2, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know what time it'll be local.
If it's at 2 o'clock local, that would make it 7 o'clock for you and 8 o'clock. 7 o'clock for me and 8 o'clock for you, I think, wasn't it? Or 8 and 9. Anyway, yeah. So I'll hopefully make it to the hotel to watch that in time. Then we've got Brno the following weekend. I don't get this. What it is? So you've got a USA round, 3 week break, another USA round, and then you've only got 5 days to get to the Czech Republic.
It does seem a little nuts. It makes the logistics of getting everything from one place to another, it seems like a little tighter than they need to be. But
unless that's part of the competition.
But yeah, maybe they know. So.
But then we've got Czech Republic, same weekend, and this is going to be one of those killer weekends. Same weekend, we've got the inaugural race in Russia from World Superbikes. So they are going to clash on times, because I think Russia's within an hour of the Czech Republic, and BSB at Cadwell Park, which is always entertaining because they got the mountain.
That should be great.
Yeah. But I can't see how on earth I'm going to be able to watch all of those. But thanks to Sky Plus, I'll do my best.
Exactly. Lots of DVR, lots of late night motorcycle
and then,
racing.
And then we've got another weekend of nothing. I hate that.
Nothing. And then, yeah. But then once we get into September, it's almost every weekend.
Yeah, in fact, it is. Yeah, we've got Nürburgring, World Superbikes, and Donington BSB, then San Marino, and of course, Circuit, there was Marco Simoncelli, as it is now called, which is rather wonderful. Then there's Portimao World Superbikes, and oh my goodness, I wish MotoGP raced there. And then we have Aragon MotoGP the weekend after. And of course, BSB going across to Assen.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That should be good.
Yeah, and that's the first round of the showdown. So, yeah, that should be very good. And then October is there's the first weekend, we've got Manicor World Superbikes, the last round. Following weekend, we got Brands Hatch, the last round of the BSB. It's another three-race weekend. And then we've got the flyaways. We've got Twin Ring Motegi. Following weekend, we've got Sepang. Following weekend, we've got Phillip Island. 1 week break, and then bang, Valencia. Wow. Best season ever.
Like always.
Oh, yeah. Until we get to next season. Right. Unless you've got anything else for the good and benefit of the listenership, Len.
I think that's just about it.
I think we're just about done. Been brilliant to have you on. Fantastic to talk to you. And thanks ever so much. And certainly for you and me, I think this is something that could work in the future. Jim and Jules obviously have a time zone coordination that makes life easy for them talking to each other. And so do you and I. So, we'll both want to talk with Jim and Jules, every now and again, just to correct them on their pronunciation of the English language.
Of course.
I appreciate you are American, but, you know, you are a traveled American. So you have more exposure to, and in fact, how many languages do you speak?
I speak two from birth, and then I speak one other one quite badly. So
that'd be Italian?
No, that'd be French.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I studied French in school, so I can get by. And then the thing with Italian is, I always say, if a Spaniard and an Italian want to understand each other, they will. They're close enough that they're understandable.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, my French, I didn't pay much attention in class. And my favorite phrase, you know that thing where you daydream, you're looking out the window, and a teacher looks at you and goes, and she said, Martin, répète, s'il vous plaît. And I thought, oh, geez. And you're trawling back in your memory thinking, I can hear some sounds she was saying. I wonder if I can recall them. And I just had to repeat the phrase she'd said. So I stood up and confidently said, mon pantalon, c'est froid. For anyone who does speak French, means my trousers are cold. What I was meant to say is my trousers are ironed, and it sounds nothing like froid. So where I got that from, I don't know. And she tried telling me off, but she was laughing too much. So that became my catchphrase in French.
It was probably better than telling her that your pants were hot.
Yes. Oh, no. The German teacher, she made my trousers hot. The French teacher, she had a moustache. No.
Ooh.
Yeah. Bad. And she was very old. At least 30, which when you're a 14-year-old schoolboy is incredibly old.
Very, very.
Right. Before Jim and Jules absolutely have kittens to go, what are these two talking about? I think we better wrap it up. So,
okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your kind attention. We will speak to you again very soon. Next week, I think I may be good for call next week, but after that, but I'm going to record a few little sound bites from the walk, so I could bore everyone silly with that. But do, if you are able, please donate. If you have friends and family who may want to donate, or just have a laugh at the website and how we're getting on with our walk, do please visit walk-on.co.uk. Thank you very much. Glenn, it's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Talk to you soon, Martin.
Absolutely. Good night, everybody.
Good night.